Welcome to the 2018 Four Seas Podcast, where we'll share stories of writing teachers and scholars, we'll talk about their work, and we'll talk about how you can get involved with groups in the Seas organization. We hope you listen and subscribe to the podcast. We'll be releasing and airing episodes today and each day of the convention. My name is Matt Gomez. I'm an assistant professor of writing, rhetoric, and American cultures at Michigan State University. Today's Saturday, March 17th, and it's the final day of the 2018 Four Seas. Before you head back home, be sure to check out some of the new additions to the convention this year. As just one example, you can check out Teacher to Teacher. Teacher to Teacher invites SEAS participants to network and learn from other teachers, students, and aspiring educators. After a short welcome and introduction, attendees will select four 20-minute table presentations per session. Attendees are welcome during any part of the morning and afternoon sessions, or as their schedules allow. Table leaders will facilitate discussion following short presentations from two teachers. A website of presentations is available in today's show notes, and the event will happen in the morning at 9:30 a.m. and in the afternoon at 12:30 p.m. That will take place in the Imperial Ballroom. Other events today include the two-year College English Association annual breakfast and awards. That'll take place in the Kansas City Marriott downtown, also in the Imperial Ballroom from 7 to 8 a.m. The annual business meeting will be happening in the Colonial Ballroom from 8 a.m. to 9:15. The Convention Concerns Committee will be meeting in the Marriott downtown in the Executive Boardroom from 12 to 1 p.m. There are also post-convention workshops, which are post-convention workshops, which will be happening from 2 to 5 p.m. this afternoon. We'll open today's episode with a discussion I had with Dr. Jay Jordan. Dr. Jordan's a member of the Committee on the Globalization of Postsecondary Writing Instruction and Research. He describes how his work on his campus at the University of Utah informed his interest in the Globalization Committee, and he talks about how the committee is helping to develop an organizational position on the phenomena of globalization and internationalization.
I'm in year three of a three-year longitudinal study following a group of students at campus that my university has. The University of Utah Asia campus is in Incheon, South Korea. It's actually in a new city that is part of the Incheon metropolitan area. My university is sharing a campus in that city with four other universities right now, and I was one of the first faculty members over there in 2014-15. I had agreed to go over to teach a course, but also provide some writing support. And I said that I wanted to do support not only for students, but for faculty. So that led me to doing a pre-service workshop and a little bit of in-service support for faculty members. And one of the effects of that was that I wanted to follow a group of students through their progress at that campus and at this campus, because it's like a 3+1 setup where students start there and they come over here to finish. So I'm following a group of about half a dozen students. I've gone on a research trip to Korea each year since I came back, and I'm going one more time in May, and I'm also writing the book, so that's under contract, and I hope to deliver the manuscripts about a year from now.
How did you first become involved with the Committee on Globalization?
I think I really became interested because of my work in Korea and because of the ways I was becoming involved with my own campus's internationalization. And I knew that there was a collection of people on that committee, folks I had already known, you know, whose work I'd already known in the field, people I admired, folks like Bruce Horner and Lu Ming Mao and Tian Donahue, and Lisa Arnold's the current chair, and I really appreciate what she does. Chris Anson and Teresa Wacky is another person who has been involved in that committee. In fact, I think she was chair of that committee previously. I've known about the work of these folks for a long time, and so that presented an opportunity for me to be involved in a committee with people whose work I knew very well and admired, who were working on trying to think through the practicalities and a lot of the other implications of globalization.
And what are the goals of the Committee on Globalization?
The committee has tried to do two things. On the one hand, it's tried to increase awareness within the 4Cs population of writing research as something that is international, that people well outside the United States do research on writing pedagogy, and that they theorize writing in a lot of different ways. It's not just a US-centric phenomenon by any means. The other thing that the committee has tried to do is to be a resource for people who are concerned about some of the impacts of globalization on education. The committee has very specific charges. A couple of our charges have to do with writing a statement about globalization and internationalization, which we're drafting right now or in the final process of drafting, and also surveying colleagues in the field about their experiences with internationalization and globalization. So we've set up, I guess, an infrastructure for learning more about how the field thinks about these issues, but we don't quite know yet. I mean, we know what we know on the committee as a result of our scholarship, but we are going to be in a process of learning what everyone else is thinking about it and what they're experiencing. And that'll be a little while. And then, the charges are issued to committees on 3-year cycles, so we'll probably spend the better part of this cycle trying to figure out how people respond, how do we analyze the data, things like that. Well, what I'm learning are some ways to ask those questions. And I'm also learning, I think anyone else on the committee would probably say this, it's been a process to negotiate with some other folks in the organization, particularly the leaders of 4Cs, about the language that we use to describe these trends in globalization and internationalization. There are a lot of words that get thrown around, like globalization is a big buzzword. A lot of universities even use it, but we need some clarity about exactly what it means. So we're trying to refine that, and we're trying to learn, I guess you could say, the best questions to ask about it.
What would you like to see as a result of your work on the committee?
Well, I think a comprehensive statement that tries to balance understanding globalization and internationalization as very broad terms, while at the same time sketching out some practical principles within the organization. I mean, other statements I've worked with, including the 4C statement on second language writing and writers, statements on equity, statements on labor expectations for non-tenure track faculty members, for example. Administrators have really responded to the statements that come from a prestigious national organization. So a statement about globalization and internationalization, I would hope would have the same effect. But I think having a statement from the organization will really be very helpful to future colleagues, and as they're trying to have a voice in these internationalization efforts. So that's a really big thing.
For you personally, and without feeling like you need to speak on behalf of the whole committee, what principles do you think should inform universities as they engage with institutions and students around the globe?
It's been very tempting for colleges and universities to respond to amount of marketing pitches, whether they are from international recruiting agencies or whether they are from foreign governments, ministries of education or educational foundations that are established in other places. We'll help you increase your international student population, or we'll help you establish a campus in this area that can be a foothold for doing other kinds of very lucrative work. So the money is kind of a draw, the prestige is a draw. And I think some institutions have been very quick to sign on to agreements. And I think that there are effects of doing that. For example, in workshops that we used to do and that are still done about second language writing, folks would come to those workshops and say some version of, I just got handed the entire ESL program at my institution, or my institution just entered a long-term agreement with an international recruiting partner. None of us knew about it. And now they're telling me, we're going to get a whole lot more international students. What are we going to do with them? As if there was no thinking about that after the fact. I would hope that one of the big principles that comes out, therefore, is first, the idea that administrators who are pursuing these sorts of partnerships really, really need to seek out expertise on their campus. We have it. Like, faculty members have a lot of expertise in these areas. If folks would just seek it out and ask us, we would much rather be consulting with administrators before a signature goes down on a long-term contract than after. So honoring the expertise that we have as faculty members, as researchers, is extremely important. And also planning for sustainable connections. It can't just be about internationalizing as a way to increase our contact with students, whether it's here or whether it's in a foreign country, that we really do need to plan for very carefully for what happens after the admission actually occurs. The student comes, student matriculates, and then at that point, it's really too late to start planning for how best to teach these students. We really need to anticipate in a way that makes those experiences sustainable. So those are two big things that I think will come out of this.
In the next segment, I talk to Marilee Grayson, whose book on racial literacy has just come out this week. In our discussion, she talks to me about her book, Racial Literacy in Writing Classrooms, and her role on the NCTE Jewish Caucus.
I'm Marilee Grayson. I'm a racial literacy educator and the co-chair of the NCTE Jewish Caucus.
Dr. Grayson's book, Teaching Racial Literacy, Reflective Practices for Critical Writing, was published this week. Today, we talk to her about her research and her work with the NCTE Jewish Caucus.
What I've been doing for the past few years and what I'm continuing right now is looking at how the discursive practices of racial literacy, so how the ways that we interrogate and decode race and racialism, but also how we respond to that with language, whether orally, in text, multimodally, how those can be used as a critical framework for teaching writing.
And what is racial literacy?
The term was first published in 2004 by Francois Danstwine, a British sociologist, and Lonnie Guinier, an American legal scholar. So they both used that term in 2004 separately. For Francois Danstwine, it was very much about identity development. She studied how white mothers of dark-skinned, biracial children raised their children to embrace a positive Black identity, especially if they were being raised in primarily white communities. Lonnie Guinier looked at race, racial literacy as an analytic paradigm through which you could interrogate how individual situations were actually representative of larger ideologies. In 2010, Francois Danstwine published a much more expanded framework. And she talked about a few characteristics of racial literacy, the final two being decoding practices and discursive practices. English education kind of jumped on it, I assume because of the term literacy, and then because of this idea of discursive practices. But in none of the research that I had read that had been produced in those years, was there any mention of what discursive practices they were referring to? So my research came in to question, well, what are these practices? And once we identify them, can we actually develop curricula that more directly speak to their inclusion as writing skills?
So how can racial literacy be used as a framework for teaching literacy?
Well, my thought is that racial literacy is literacy. I think we take that for granted sometimes because of the word literacy, but in order to turn it into pedagogy and something that we can also study in an effective way and then implement, we have to really parse out what those literacy elements are. Things like personal sharing, which is something most of us do when we talk about questions of race, we identify, right? We start to think about how we connect with the world. That teaches us about authorial positionality and ethos. When we think about how we communicate with another person, if we ask questions, if we identify them as something, we're questioning or falling into the sort of the trap of identifying audience, maybe without questioning. So by looking at those things that we're doing and encouraging students to look more metacognitively at how they're addressing that, they can start to do the same thing in their writing, whether or not they're writing directly about race or something else.
What are some of the discursive practices of racial literacy?
Personal sharing is probably the most obvious and the most prevalent. Labeling or questioning labels, how we identify whether we fit into one of those standard US Census boxes about race, or if we don't, most of us don't. Representation, so how are we being represented and how does that tell us something about authorship and also audience? For me, this is the most interesting one because it's the one that race scholars really don't like, is hedging. So hedging, most famously or infamously, is, you know, I'm not racist, but .. right? And that's obviously problematic for a number of reasons, typically because it signifies you're about to say something offensive. I didn't see that exact example in any of the classrooms or texts that I studied, in terms of student-produced texts, but I did see a lot of I'm sorry or no offense, I didn't mean that. And this is generally seen as a pretty negative aspect of racial discourse because we're not amending what we're saying after it. We're just giving the disclaimer and saying something negative anyway. But in terms of writing development, it's a little more interesting and a little more, I'd say a lot more complex. In second language acquisition, hedging is actually seen as a marker of competence. Once you're able to sort of hedge or frame information, you have a little more of a nuanced understanding of language, right? So we couch our language a bit more because we're more aware of audience and more aware of what we know and what we don't know.
So how did your research in racial literacy lead you towards your work with the NCTE Jewish Caucus?
I've sort of been surrounded by, without the phrase racial literacy, I've been surrounded by that type of work and that framework my whole life. I grew up around social workers and political activists and in a very diverse family. And so our conversations were always really explicit and we talked about identity, we talked about race, we talked about inequity. And then I found that doing this racial literacy work, we really weren't talking about the variability between white culture because we viewed whiteness as this one thing. I contacted the chairs of the Jewish Caucus about a year ago, asking how I could get more involved because I didn't see any conversations about this happening in the organization, at the convention, at NCTE, at CS. This didn't seem to be a conversation that was going on. And as somebody who wants to engage in every uncomfortable conversation possible, because I think that's how we learn and that's how our students learn, I was a little frustrated by that. And then I pretty quickly, because it turned out one of the chairs was leaving, I came on as a co-chair of the Jewish Caucus, along with Dave Bloom.
And what do you hope is a result of your work with the NCTE Jewish Caucus?
There is pretty big representation historically in the field of education of Jewish people, but the Jewish issues, whatever that means, and I'm talking really just issues of representation and identity. So how are we being portrayed in texts? How are we being brought into the classroom? Are our stories being told, or are we just getting that, you know, as Adichie says, that one single story? What I want to do is be able to talk about what it means to be a Jewish American, not necessarily in a way of religiosity, but in a way of culture. In the Jewish communities that I was a part of, resistance and protest were intrinsic parts of what it meant to be Jewish in this country. And it's so easy right now to break up and fight each other instead of fighting the larger structures that are making this a problem. Jewish Americans have always stood with people who are being minoritized. And I really want to, as a racial literacy educator and also as a Jewish woman, I really want to bring that into conversation to ask how not only can we fight for our own representation, but how can we be allies for others who might need allies that have been absorbed into whiteness? Because we benefit from that privilege pretty often. So how can I use that to do more good in the world rather than in only one little pocket of identity?
Mara, are there any NCTE Jewish Caucus events you want to highlight?
We are co-sponsoring at least one panel at NCTE 2018 in November. And we have a few more events coming up, but I would say right now, because we are in this time of transition, we're really building up to some bigger future things. I would really love it if anybody who is interested in getting involved, they could just contact me. And we're always looking for more people who want to have this conversation and have ideas for innovative ways to go about doing it. We do have a few things coming up, so I would say stay tuned for NCTE. But again, if there's something that anyone in the organization, either related to their own identity, their representation in the organization, or pedagogy, we would love to hear how you want to help out.
For today's final interview, I talked to Dr. Raymond Ohnbring, a member of the International Researchers Consortium. Dr. Ohnbring discusses his involvement with the consortium and how that involvement is influencing his research and work around Creole Englishes in the Caribbean. In previous episodes of the podcast, we've talked to members of the International Researchers Consortium, including Professors Christiane Donahue, Violeta Molina Natera, and Lance Cummings. Today, we conclude our segments on the International Researchers Consortium by talking to Dr. Raymond Ohnbring, an assistant professor at the College of the Bahamas and a member of the consortium.
3 years ago, I participated in their talks at Four Seas. I think I've been to three over the years. It was definitely good to see that there are other people outside the United States that are engaging in research on the best practices in teaching and writing. That was how I met Dr. Milson White, first time in face-to-face, and a book project came of that out of our discussions, so that was definitely great.
That collection, Creole Composition, is planned to come out in 2019. Can you say a bit more about your collection, Creole Composition?
Is an edited collection with Dr. Milson White and a colleague here, and it will be the first edited collection involving composition scholars from around the Anglophone Caribbean. Although we have a long tradition of teaching composition in the Anglophone Caribbean at the post-secondary level, it's kind of been untheorized, used very traditional models. We have contributors from the Bahamas, Jamaica, Barbados, Virgin Islands, possibly a few other places. Most of them are not composition theorists because composition pedagogy is, it's not a well-developed thing in the Caribbean. These are composition instructors who are trying to make an intervention into the discourse about best practices in teaching writing in the Anglophone Caribbean. We have a variety of contributors. We have some empirical studies. We have some more theoretical pieces. A major theme is Anglophone Caribbean countries are by and large countries where people speak English Creoles. That's why the book's called Creole Composition. And there's definitely some valuable overlap in the experience of teaching composition in one Caribbean country versus another.
And for folks who may not know, can you tell us, what are Creole languages?
The Creole languages are mixed languages that developed during the colonial era when slaves were brought over to the Caribbean and were intentionally separated from speakers of the same African languages to reduce the chance of revolt. And they learned a version of English that demonstrated the influence of their mother tongues. We can broadly think of a Creole language as a mixed language involving a mixture of English and African languages, if you will. It involves a few African loan words. It has some unique phonological and syntactic features.
And what do you hope readers will take away from your collection, Creole Composition?
For American scholars, I think it's definitely important for the field of composition studies to continue to internationalize itself, to avoid kind of the myopia of a discipline based only in one country. From my perspective, it's important to internationalize the field so that we can avoid the stigma of composition studies being seen as, this is my, in my unique situation, it is seen as American ideas. We need to make it these Caribbean ideas too. It's easy to dismiss some of the things that American compositionists say if they only see Americans talking about this.
I want to thank you again for listening today to the 2018 Four Seas podcast. In the notes for today's episode, you'll find links to things discussed, including the schedule for teacher-to-teacher presentations. Finally, over the last few days, I've asked you to share with me what you've learned from the convention. I want to take a few moments to share what our listeners have been learning.
I think the most important thing that I've learned from this conference is how amazing it is to connect with my fellow compositionists. I was nervous coming to the conference, since this is my first time, but everybody's just been so open and authentic and welcoming, and it's just been an amazing experience. Thank you.
Hello, I have loved the diversity of this conference. I spoke with a scholar from Nepal, and we were discussing research papers for our composition classes, and he explained that often he finds international students have a more difficult time providing evidence to support their points in research, and it's partly because of their culture. And this opened my eyes to the idea that different cultures have different ways of persuading. Thank you.
If you have additional feedback, I'd love to hear it. You can share by calling and leaving a voicemail at 508-348-9128. Your contributions may be included in future episodes of the podcast. Thanks again, and I hope you're all having a beautiful day.